Welcome to
the second Danilo Husarstrup Memorial Lecture. The first was given last year by Professor Marco Paulishan. The Danilo Husarstrup Memorial Lecture is an annual lecture initiated by the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies by the Danilo Husarstrup Program in Ukrainian Literature, which was created in 1999 after Danilo's death. The purpose of the program in Ukrainian literature is to promote and advance the study of Ukrainian literature in the English-speaking world. The program in Ukrainian literature, with its modest budget, has undertaken to do this with three specific tasks. The first is this annual lecture series. The second aspect of our activity is the Electronic Library of Ukrainian Literature, an internet project I have initiated to collect and present on the internet texts in Ukrainian literature, particularly for students in university courses. I invite you to visit the site. The third aspect of our activity is to stimulate translations. Inasmuch as translations don't happen overnight and aren't as quick as internet web pages, there is as yet only hope on the horizon of fruits in that area. The Danilo Husarstrup Memorial Lecture honors Professor Danilo Strug, a member of the Slavic Department at this university, an outstanding scholar, best known in the scholarly community for his stewardship of the Encyclopedia of Ukraine project, which appears to the public eye as five published volumes of the English language encyclopedia, and a project that I may say continues with ambitious goals for the future. Danilo Strug, in addition to his work on the encyclopedia, was a prominent literary scholar, and of course it's in that area that we honor him tonight. His particular expertise was in 20th century, in the analysis of 20th century writers, particularly poets. He is known for his work on Stefanik, he's known for his work on Kalinets, known for his work on Andijevska. Tonight, we are greatly honored to have as our speaker one of the most prominent specialists in Ukrainian literature anywhere. Professor George Grabovich is the Dmytro Czyżewski Professor of Ukrainian Literature at Harvard University. He is the former president of the International Association of Ukrainian Studies, and he holds a great many honors and distinguished titles. He is, of course, best known for his work on Taras Shevchenko. He is the author of the outstanding monograph, Poet as Mythmaker. This monograph has also appeared in Ukrainian translation, as have a great many of his works. And he is the author of the recently published Shevchenko, Yakoho Neznaim, the Shevchenko we don't know. He is also the founder and editor-in-chief of one of Ukraine's most prominent intellectual magazines entitled Kritika. Today's topic, one that has occupied Professor Grabovich for some time, certainly at least since his dissertation, is entitled Taras Shevchenko as a National Poet, a comparison with Pushkin and Mickiewicz. I give you Professor Grabovich.
Ladies and gentlemen, Danilo Strug was a friend and colleague. I took delight in his company and his wit. I admired his remarkable commitment to his field. I was always stimulated by his ideas and the energy that he radiated. It's a great honor and pleasure to give this lecture in his memory. Now, the topic, as you were just told, is on Shevchenko, but it actually is an intersection of two topics or two themes that I have been working on for some time now. For Shevchenko for about 20 years or so, and quite recently on a topic that is larger than that and subsumes it, namely the idea, the phenomenon, and the role of national poets. And at this intersection, I would like to orient our thoughts. Now, in the formation of modern national literatures and of modern national identities, a central moment, both in the gestation and in its immediate and proximate historiographic recollection, is the articulation, or as the deconstructivists would say, the invention or the construction of the national poet. Now, the iconic role of writers is probably universal in literature, whether as canonic object, as a source of the anxiety of influence, or as ideological topos, it drives, it animates the very process of literary reception. The literary cultures of Europe, and maybe particularly of East Central Europe, both in the 19th and 20th centuries, are particularly rich in this respect. Each national tradition has its own iconostasis, of course, and various writers, such as Kundera or Milosz, Brodsky or Nabokov, assume even a kind of transnational role. Arguably, however, the iconic process has a core, at the very least a point of origin, and this is the nexus of the national poet. In their respective cultures, such writers as Shevchenko or Petefi, Mickiewicz and Eminescu, Pushkin and Macha, have come to symbolize both the literature and the nation. Indeed, a transcendent and empowering conflation of the two. Understandably, this very transcendence and empowerment constitutes a key problem in any rethinking and contextualization of the individual literary process and of their interaction. Now, the material subsumed under the topic of the national poet involves several important and interconnected areas of study: intellectual and literary history, canon formation and reception theory, and the broad field of social and cultural studies that deals with collective and symbolic representations, with collective memory, and with myth and myth-making. Although each subset has a voluminous background literature, a synthesizing approach to the subject still seems to be lacking. An interdisciplinary locus, of course, invariably presents its own special challenges, and this may be one of the reasons why this subject really has not been addressed as it perhaps should have been. But the matter is complicated here by the fact that, by default, the topic has been left to literary historians, and in the main to those who, in today's idiom, would be labeled nationalist. Now, we, of course, know that in the way and without maybe due care. Now, whatever the other ramifications, it is particularly evident that the discourse surrounding the national poet is somehow imminently autarkic, closed in, as it were. And this applies as well to recent scholarship that is not avowedly nationalist, such as, for example, Western Slavistics. The traditional national scholarship, generated as it is by a symbolic and collective sense of and social need for asserting identity, is understandably predisposed or perhaps even programmed to look inward and to keep what is outside at bay or at least out of focus. To put it very simply, the very fact of looking at a central national emblem suggests or implies that one needs to keep everything else out of the picture. The non-national scholarship, i.e. Western Slavistics, is not explicitly so programmed, but the power of inertia and of unconscious imitation of the heartland, the Rodina, if you will, seems to work just as effectively at maintaining a selective, nation-centered perspective. In a word, the comparative focus, that contextualization is essential for seeing the phenomenon clearly and analytically, and that has been largely absent. And it is a structured absence, as I just suggested. In every national tradition, the attention paid to the national poet has been immense and continuous, but it is precisely the comparative discussion that has been lacking. And this is made all the more obvious in the Slavic context in that they are so close to each other. And an illustrative principle for this would be the recent bicentennial celebrations both for Mickiewicz and Pushkin. At neither of these was the fact of the contacts between these and other such national poets stressed. Is the paradigm, however, universal or particular? Does every literature, in effect every society or nation, have its national poet? At first glance, it seems apparent that while the notion and the historiographic topos of national poet is extremely widespread, and if you look at the internet availability bibliographic search engines, you will see that it appears in context of Iceland and Australia, Malta, and literature written in Hebrew in 19th century Russia, but it is in fact not universal. France, for example, seems to be lacking a consensus on this. When pressed on the point of who is the French national poet, André Gide reportedly said, "Victor Hugo, hélas." The qualification is telling. Another response, one which I heard from French participants in the Mickiewicz Congress in Paris in 1998, was, "We don't have national poets, we have national dishes." Now, an empirical Englishman subsequently corrected that, saying there are no national French dishes, there are only regional French dishes. Something similar, as far as national poets goes, obtains in American literature. Most knowledgeable respondents would suggest Walt Whitman for that high office, but there is no consensus. Presumably, a similar situation, and here I am ready to be corrected, obtains in Canada, where, presumably, the distinction between Anglophone and Francophone communities, and beyond that, the official doctrine of multiculturalism, would, presumably, dictate the absence of such a consensus. But I really can't tell for sure. The same certainly applies to Belgium. And indeed, we would intuitively assume that this would be the case for most, if not all, federal multi-ethnic states. In some cases, as in Dutch literature, the central and most esteemed writer may be a prose writer, like Multatuli, Edward Duys Dekker, but not a poet. That too may be significant for the kind of relationship or social contract that exists between the canonized writer and his audience. In some cases, as in Australia, the national poet, Ern Malley, is a national hoax. I'll come back to that in another context. The absence of universality does not, of course, preclude the need to discern patterns and regularities and to identify the enabling, if not unequivocally essential, features. One may postulate that as a rule, and there are exceptions, of course, the national poet is a function of pre-Romantic and then with great intensity of Romantic poetics, and with it a historical nexus where the given society or nation creates or canonizes its national poet in the process of crystallizing or formulating its own, or reformulating its own identity. The pattern is most obvious in Slavic countries, but it also applies to nations with seemingly stable identity. As recent research has demonstrated, the canonization of Shakespeare as the English national poet coincides both with the political unrest at the end of the 17th century, and in turn, when this occurred actually, and in turn draws on the manifest period of crisis of Shakespeare's own time. In short, the notion of national poet has its own historicity. Roughly speaking, its origins lie in the Enlightenment and in such allied notions as the natural man and the noble savage, in genius and genius loci, in the search for the modern day equivalent of Homer and the belief in the special and yet untapped creative energy of the primitive. The quintessential articulation of this was the creation of Ossian, which channeled the heuristic and imaginative power of these ideas to the sublime task of revealing and justifying national literatures and with it and through it, of national identity. Now, the fact that ASEAN was soon exposed as a mystification was not an impediment to the success of the mythologem and its transformation into a touchstone of romantic poetics. Even after the fact of Macpherson's authorship became incontrovertible, Johann Gottfried Herder, the philosopher of nationalism and the father of the seminal paradigm of the folk, the narod, remained an essential supporter of the ASEANic concept. He simply could not give it up. What must be stressed, however, and what is of special interest here, is, and I will be returning to this, is the uncomfortably close proximity of the idea of national poet and the underlying ideas of genius, national identity, and the national literature that is its voice to the practice and, if you will, national sanctioning of literary mystifications. ASEAN characteristically created ad majorem gloriam nationis, becomes the paradigm that was soon to be repeated by the Kralevodvorsky and Zelenohorsky manuscripts and the Igor tale, and similar literary mystifications from the late 19th century Uralinda book of the Frisians to the post-World War II Velesova Kneha, or Vles Kneha for the Russians and the Ukrainians. This obverse side of the mythical construct of the national poet, i.e. the national poem, is central to the overall phenomenon, especially the dynamics of creation, and I will briefly return to it. In the Romantic period proper, the role of the poet as bard is strongly adumbrated and initially, as it were, projected by the social, political, and psychological features of the Byronic model. To speak of it, that is say Byron and Byronism, as an influence or fashion is to underestimate its impact. For continental Europe, England, of course, is the exception, but no man is a prophet in his own country, it becomes for a time the essential model. The earliest portraits of Mickiewicz are all cast in a Byronic mode, the poet as another Byron, as it were. It becomes for a time the essential model, and its fusion of political dissent and indeed involvement in the liberation struggle and of acerbic social criticism, the sense of personal mystery and of some dark fate or fatum hanging over one's life, and not least of all, aesthetic subtlety and indeed a kind of refined dandyism become a new paradigm. Now, while some features may change and emphases may be modulated, this image becomes iconic, certainly for the poets that I will discuss here. For Mickiewicz, as reflected not only in the portraits I just mentioned, but in his early poetry, this is a basic frame of reference. The same is true for Pushkin, despite the fact, and indeed precisely because he also thematizes the Byronic icon, he pokes fun at it, as it were, and himself within it, and subjects it to that very irony that is part and parcel of the Byronic legacy. Even Shevchenko, who on the surface, that is to say, in light of his own self-portrayals and his subsequent iconic portrayal in the general reception as a poet of the common people, a kobzar, or minstrel, even though he would seem distant from this Byronic model, it is also firmly within his legacy, particularly the essential components of political and social rebelliousness and of a dark fatum or curse that hangs over the poet. In effect, the transition from the model of Byronic poet to that of national poet involves a massive conflation of the literary and cultural with the social and political contexts. In each of the societies in question, to turn now to our topic at hand, the Ukrainian, the Polish, and the Russian, the social and political conditions are so propitious, and the need for a reconfiguration and restating of national identity so overwhelming, that the respective poet, having already achieved unparalleled prominence during his lifetime, becomes shortly after his death an unchallenged culture hero, and by the end of the century, the unchallenged national icon. One can say without exaggeration, and there are massive bibliographies for each of these writers, that for all of them, that for each of their respective nations, societies, Mickiewicz, Pushkin, and Shevchenko, moving through largely analogous stages of apotheosis, first as bard, then as martyr, then as prophet, become massive cult figures, the very epitomes of the national spirit, deified heroes in the secular religion of each of these societies. And yet there are various differences, which I obviously will go into. A final preliminary issue concerns the functional equivalence of the various designations or names. That is to say, the term Vyesh given for Mickiewicz, or Kobzar for Shevchenko, or Nationalny Poet, as was used for Pushkin. They are all, I think, essentially equivalent, and yet there are various nuances. Although it is evident from what I've just said that an essentialist and metaphysical reading of each poet and his national role, in effect the belief that his sublime prominence is due to the fact that he incarnates the voice and thus the spirit of the nation, is hardly adequate as a critical or historiographic notion, the matter may be put more directly. The national poet is made, not born. The national poet, as can be demonstrated in each of these three cases, is a product of a process of reception, which, with altogether clearly discernible stages and players in the process, with social forces at work that are large and awesome, but clearly subject to analysis. The prominent role that teleological thinking plays here, the idea that these poets were preternaturally fated to assume their respective roles, the belief that theirs is an organic and essential manifestation of the national ethos, are all largely unconscious, but highly determined and coded facets of the overall reception process, all resonating within the given social context, and only now receiving, I think, some adequate attention. But even as recently as in the 1950s, this was a subject still quite virgin territory. This, of course, is not to imply, and here we become coming to a more problematic area, that the actual creative output, the oeuvre of the poet, is somehow secondary in the process of his canonization, as if to say it's not important what he, or she perhaps, but usually it's he, writes, it's the way that it is perceived. Obviously, it doesn't work that way. On the contrary, that work, that oeuvre, is the very core of the process. On the one hand, the very choice of thematic focus, the fact of Mickiewicz's Pantadeusz focusing on what it focuses, or Pushkin's Boris Godunov, or Shevchenko's Haidamake, to point only to central narratives in each of these poets' canons, is such that it, that narrative, that work, looks unerringly to the key moments in the nation's experience and ethos, and in so doing lays a powerful claim to speak in the name of the entire collective, of the nation itself. There are many examples, but let me give just a few for each. Shevchenko's major political poem, Poslanie, may serve as a paradigmatic case. Its subtitle, To My Dead, Living, and Still Unborn Countrymen, Żywym, Mertwym I Nienarodzennym Ziemlekam Moim, born in Ukraine and outside of it, manifestly lays claim to an ineffable bond, a transrational bond, with the collective. A bond, he later develops, that transcends time and place and is indeed a kind of a sacred trust, a sacred mission. And the same is true of the others, although they each may be said in somewhat different nuances, somewhat different keys. Already in his Konrad Wallenrod of 1828, Mickiewicz, speaking through his eponymous hero, was laying claim, and still in a masked and Byronic mode, to being a secret leader of and martyr to the nation's cause. In Dziady, Forefathers Eve, Part 3, the revelation of the poet hero through his symbolic second birth and self-rechristening as Konrad, and his claim to representation of and spiritual leadership over the nation is given quite, I mean, utterly directly. He says, I and the fatherland are one. I am called Million because for millions I love and suffer torments. In the books of the Polish nation and Polish pilgrimage, written that very same year, Księgi Narodu I Pielgrzymstwa Polskiego, a brochure that was both symbolically and literally intended as a catechism for the Polish immigration and for Poland itself. The role of speaking to and instructing the nation is amplified both by the biblical diction and stance and the messianic doctrine that it conveys, a doctrine in which the chosen preternatural role of poet-prophet is at the center. Finally, even in Pan Tadeusz, which can serve, as I have argued in an earlier work, as an epitaph for the poem, paradoxically, because it's such a long epic poem, and yet it is the equivalent of a short epitaph on a tombstone, even while it assumes the grandiose dimensions of a nation's epos, the poet's bond and identification with the nation is ever present. Pushkin's self-inscription into the collective consciousness, his assumption of spiritual leadership, and ultimately the mantle of prophecy, follows an analogous path. Although it is molded by his biographical circumstances and its literary discourse of his society, particularly its salon culture, and the overarching importance it places on distance, irony, and wit. It's very hard to pretend or to lay claim to being a prophet if one has to do it with these qualities, with irony and wit. Still, the bardic national stance is assumed at a very early age. For example, in his Freedom, an ode, Wolność Oda, of 1818, where the 20-year-old poet already speaks to his nation and its recent history as both a contemplative seer, echoing the poetry of the North, i.e. ASEAN, and indeed, in the spirit of what Shelley said, that is to say, of poets as unacknowledged legislators of mankind, as an unacknowledged lawgiver. In the poetry that follows, the light and playful and ironic is continually matched, whether in echoes of the Decembrist uprising and works written to the Tsar himself, in comments on Russia's colonization of the Caucasus, the well-known ending of the Prisoner of the Caucasus, or his comments on the Polish uprising of 1831, his historical works, particularly Poltava, by a stance that implicitly arrogates to the poet the role of speaking in the name of Russia itself. The examples are numerous, and the poetics are subtle, and obviously the topic requires further attention. But as with Mickiewicz and Shevchenko, Pushkin overtly assumes the diction and iconic role of prophecy. In fact, has several poems to that very theme. Now, the matter may be put more directly. Not only do the poets in question address their societies and their respective collective experiences through a broad thematic range, and by prioritizing history and the central social and political issues, ideologically, so to say, and formally substantiate their claim to a personal, intimate, indeed one-to-one relationship with the nation and its experience, they also directly inscribe, i.e. program, their reception. This is the secret, which is on the one hand evident, at the same time not all that apparent. This is what I have been calling in some of my writings on this topic, symbolic autobiography. Most generally, the sense of symbolic autobiography involves not so much the writer's readiness to reveal key moments of his internal and hidden life as to endow them with both narrative extension and a certain narrative autonomy, and in particular to thematize them, to make himself a theme within his narrative. In the case of Shevchenko, Mickiewicz, and Pushkin, this thematization is precisely in the direction of the poet as bard, and then with ever greater intensity of the poet as preternaturally chosen, indeed of a transcendent sacred poet-prophet. Along with self-reflection and self-consciousness, what defines symbolic autobiography and gives it its peculiar resonance is not the autobiographic moment or event or detail as such, but precisely its symbolic encoding. In Shevchenko, who, along with Mickiewicz, provides a paradigmatic instance of symbolic autobiography, this encoding conforms to the basic structures of his mythopoesis and involves such key moments as the conflation of his fate with the fate of the nation. From his earliest poetry, virtually from Perebendia, and, well, not Prichinna maybe, but certainly from the first Kobzar, through the various narrative poems, ending with Maria, for example, whereby his trials recapitulate the trials of the collective. And in terms of the movement between and recapitulation of the tension between communitas and structure, between the common people and authority. And specifically, in his case, the enabling reciprocal relationship between the poet self-projected as both sinner and prophet. In effect, in each of our cases, the poet perceives and intuits both the dominant ideology, that is to say, the values, the collective anxieties and memory, and so on, of his society, and his own power or chosenness. As Harold Bloom has argued, a strong poet is always ready to affirm his chosenness, and that would appear to be axiomatic for a national poet. In order to be that, he has to feel that he has been chosen. And by articulating a symbolic, even though at times fragmentary and implicit, master narrative that conflates his life and that of the collective, he, in a sense, is providing already a blueprint for his subsequent reception. He is telling us how to read him. Imperceptibly, he leads the reader and then the critic to accept a new script, and with it a new and unprecedented and unique role for the author. Not only how to read him, but how not to read him. That is to say, not the way you read the older poets, but in a new way. The process, of course, is synergistic. It goes both ways. And it depends on very early, unequivocal validation, which in the case of all three is biographically attested. That is to say, from the very beginning, they have to get maximum approval. In the case of Mickiewicz, fate herself provided for the fact that he was born on Christmas Eve. His parents continued the pattern by calling him Adam. The sense of chosenness was encrypted very early. The process of such grandiose self-identification is always extremely risky. Misjudging one's power and the poetics of reception and the social code involved opens up the risk of ridicule. But great achievement is always contingent on great risk. Characteristically, too, and these are all risk takers, all of these poets, that's why they're good. Characteristically, too, all three poets find subtle means, primarily through the use of irony, self-irony, and masking, to deflect and to control the risk involved. The sense of risk is communicated to the audience because they're seeing new works, new ways of writing, new ways of thinking and feeling, and thus contributes to the expectations and the aura of success and chosenness that is generated by the poet and that in time becomes its own teleology. In other words, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. On the personal psychological readiness level, the readiness to take risks, to dare, is common, as the biographical evidence shows, to all three poets, although it is most often discussed in connection with Pushkin and his, at times seemingly foolhardy, predilection for duels and his death in the duel. I mean, he was courting death. In purely literary terms, it is most revealing that all three poets project the sense of risk-taking and challenging their audience, which are, I would say, two sides of the same coin, by engaging in unprecedented formal innovation, which I just mentioned, within their respective literary traditions and in the literary craft as such. They are great innovators. In short, the claim to chosenness must be substantiated at the outset, although it is also clear that the full extent of the poet's aesthetic achievement becomes apparent only to subsequent generations. Along with the psychological encoding and the aesthetic and formal innovation, a central moment is that which we can call discursive fit. In each case, the poet unerringly recognizes and develops that discursive mode that is operant in his society or central to his society, which resonates with its collective self and its mode of dealing with that sense. This, of course, is synergistic also, and it may even seem tautologous or banal, i.e. saying little more than the poet talks to his audience in a manner that it will understand. But the point, I believe, is important. In the historical and existential sense, the national poet is tantamount to or basically comprehensible only within the national discourse. That's why it's so difficult to translate them, and that is why it is so difficult for other collectives to understand the esteem and the adulation. And one of the answers for why there's so little comparative work done on this. It refers back to what I said earlier, that in the absence of such an enabling discourse, the paradigm itself does not arise. In France, there was no room for a national poet because there was a larger national hero, Napoleon. There was no slot. In the case of Poland, Mickiewicz as national poet, as Wieszcz, is fully comprehensible only if one also factors in the powerful role of Polish romantic messianism, which he himself, of course, was the first to articulate and generate, but which, this must be stressed, goes beyond him. Messianism is not coterminous with Mickiewicz. The fact that his preeminence, Mickiewicz's, was challenged by the other great Polish romantic poet, Juliusz Słowacki, who also claimed to be a Wieszcz, and that later Zygmunt Krasiński attempted to further expand the idea by proposing himself as a synthesis, Mickiewicz thesis, Słowacki antithesis, Krasiński synthesis, suggests that in the given discourse, the idea of the national poet and the concrete person who occupied the role were indeed distinct. Krasiński's ultimate failure in inscribing his theory of the three Wieszczes into the collective consciousness also suggests that in the reception process, the ideological discourse cannot ignore the aesthetic factor, the fact that you have to be really very good to apply for this job, and that the options for manipulating it are circumscribed. It's not an endless supply of options, as it were. Analogously to Mickiewicz, Shevchenko both inscribes his sense of millenarian populism on the Ukrainian public and resonates with its pre-existent variant. As a national poet, as the father of the nation, this should be put in quotes, he can hardly be understood outside of that paradigm. And again, he is not coterminous with it. He is also a product of a process of reception and a nexus of other paradigms, of Slavophile, Herderian, all-Russian, federalist, proto-national, and so on. And they have all created the dynamic state of flux since his canonization as national martyr. Already in 1876, and I want to quote from this, in a lengthy article on Shevchenko, Ukrainofili i Socializm, Shevchenko, the Ukrainophiles and Socialism, the eminent Ukrainian thinker and political theorist Mikhailo Drahomanov, then a political dissident in Geneva, speaks of the various mutually exclusive and contradictory socio-political interpretations of Shevchenko within Ukrainian society. All of them, however, as contradictory, as mutually opposed as they are, implicitly accepting and celebrating the national poet. This is how Drahomanov begins in a short, as it were, summation, the first part of his brochure. Let me read it first in Ukrainian, and if need be, I can translate it into English. It says, «Із одної печі та не одні речі. Шевченко вже не безумний патріот. Шевченко ніколи й не був сепаратистом. Шевченко – ворог Росії і Польщі і козако-український республіканець. Шевченко – ворог Росії. Шевченко – мирний патріот. Шевченко – пророк своєї хати і своєї мудрості, яка вберегла від джуми нігілізму. Шевченко – не соціаліст і не революціонер, а законний австрійський поступовець. Шевченко – не современний українофіл. Шевченко – нігіліст і соціаліст. Шевченко – Христос і Беліал. Шевченко – для посвячених і непосвячених. Так завше з пророками. Should I translate? Did anyone not understand? All right. a similar plurality of interpretations, all still subsumed by the overarching paradigm of national poet, is equally apparent in the respective receptions of Mickiewicz and Pushkin. To say a plurality of contradictory interpretations, and yet all held together by this overarching paradigm. The case of the latter, of Pushkin, is particularly revealing for the way in which it shows how the national poet functions and thrives not only in nation societies, which, like the Polish and Ukrainian, are undergoing profound political crisis. One can even postulate that the reason you have national poets is because the society has experienced such a profound crisis that it needs to focus on a savior figure, as it were. But it's not exactly, certainly not a political crisis only. And therefore, project a national poet as an antidote to political subjugation and as a symbol of and a strategy for attaining independence. Indeed, that was the case with Mickiewicz and Shevchenko. But also, it is evident in a society that is attempting to come to grips with its imperial sense of self and at the same time accommodate the stirrings of nationalism, a process which still has not played itself out in Russia. And finally, at the same time, has and had great feelings of inferiority, especially vis-a-vis the West. For his part, Pushkin inscribes himself into the surrounding imperial discourse at times with apparent fervor, and this, of course, is so contradictory with some of the iconic features that one wants to discover. That is to say, in the already mentioned Prisoner of the Caucasus, which ends with an apotheosis of Russia's conquest of the Caucasus, which is still going on. Or to the Slanderers of Russia, his answer to the Poles in 1831, or Poltava. But at the same time, he is drawing important nuances and focusing on the crushing, and this also has to be seen, on the crushing malevolent side of the cause of empire, paradigmatically in the Bronze Horseman, Miedny Всадник, but also in the Captain's Daughter, and most strikingly in the late lyrics that anticipate and all but predict his death. What is most striking in the Pushkin reception, however, and an instance that does set it apart from the analogous Mickiewicz and Shevchenko phenomena, is that a distinct turning point in that reception can be identified. For in a real sense, Pushkin began as a very unlikely candidate for national poet. One would think that going by tradition and external evident moments, the national writer, if not national poet, should have been Tolstoy, the great lover of the narod. Began as I say, an unlikely candidate. His embeddedness in the elite, salon culture of the day, his irony and wit, his predilection for parody, his programmatic aristocraticism, eroticism, and dandyism. All that in the face of the fact that in Russian culture the notion of nation was, as in most other Slavic cultures, often blurred with the narod, i.e. the people, all of this did not augur well for his future canonization. The need for a culture hero clearly took precedence, however, and his death in a duel was immediately transformed into martyrdom in the collective public opinion of the intelligentsia, which itself, and this I stress, they needed it, and they also had an analogous role, which itself, that is to say, the intelligentsia, occupied the ambiguous role, echoing that of Pushkin himself, of being both dependent on and politically dissident to the state. But the defining moment was the Pushkin celebration of 1880. Particularly the culminating speech by Dostoevsky, in which he inscribes Pushkin into a new messianic Russian nationalism and takes what was long bemoaned by Russian critics as Russia's weakness, i.e. her derivativeness, her imitativeness, and on the basis of Pushkin's perceived openness to all cultures and models, now recasts it as the very essence of his and her greatness and universalism. As much as this may be a hijacking, as a recent very astute study of this says by Levitt, As much as this may have been a hijacking of the historical Pushkin, it is emblematic of the way in which the national poet functions as a mirror, indeed a protean force for the societal needs that drive all literary reception. Now, this problem of reception is something, and canon formation is one, this is something that must occupy a central place in our deliberations. And let me make a few more compact points on this score. From this perspective, a comparative perspective, it may be argued that Pushkin's canonization was the one that was most manipulated by official forces and governmental conjunctura. As Levitt notes, there was indeed a pronounced debate in the 1860s as to whether pronouncing him a world-class genius meant in some measure to sanction Russia's oppressive political, economic, and cultural order. And indeed, debates about Pushkin's appropriateness for this role, or indeed whether he was adequate, were not only confined to this one phase. An even much stronger period of criticism of him was after the Decembrist uprising. As one participant in the 1860s debate said, quote, "Do you really think that given the state of Russian society, Shakespeare's and Goethe's are possible? True, equally strong talents are met in all ages, but they can only reach fullness of development in times of the most flourishing enlightenment. Karamzin, Zhukovsky, and Pushkin serve as the standard for the highest literary merit that could have matured in present-day Russian society. But can you really say that they achieved the full height they might have achieved given different social conditions?" End quote. Now, the argument is actually double-edged, because while denying Russia's adequacy as a state, it also elevates the soul. Russian genius is all the more sublime in that it asserts itself and that it thrives against such odds. In any case, the argument can be made, and I must put it here in a more succinct form, that the canonizations of Mickiewicz and Shevchenko seem much more organic and spontaneous. At the very least, after the poet's death, there is no hiatus. There is no debate at all as to their respective sublime status. Indeed, there is little of that debate even during their lifetimes. Mickiewicz was a national poet already when in exile in Russia. He was, as it were, delegated by history, it would seem, but in fact, it was the initial Russian reception of him as the preeminent Polish poet that, in a sense, put him on society's map. So when he left Russia in 1828, he was already, as it were, cloaked in that aura. And, of course, he himself, and already mentioned Konrad Wallenrod, in a symbolically autobiographical way, projects himself as poet martyr, a national leader, fated somehow to die mysteriously. For Shevchenko, the process is perhaps even more organic. To speak of the stages of his canonization is simply to speak of the stages of his literary revelation, of his coming on the scene, because it is a pure curve of ascendancy. There are no downs. So his first Kobzar of 1840, then the Haidamake of 1841, then the first visit to Ukraine, then the arrest, then exile, then return, and then his death, and utter or total canonization. Let me quote from a moment which I find particularly dramatic. There are numerous reminiscences and memoirs of Shevchenko. It's in various volumes, and there seems to be additional material that could be included. But one of the most striking is written by a Ukrainian student, Feoktil Khartakhai, who was present at the funeral of Shevchenko. And I would like to read it to you. It's not a well-known passage at all, but it resonates with so much sense of the sacred that I think it almost requires no commentary. And in fact, we know from history that when this letter arrived in Kharkiv, it stimulated people to an unprecedented sort of involvement in the Ukrainian cause. This was in 1861. So he's talking about the funeral. He said there were 15 speeches. And then, «Привинусі труни ні одна проста рука до неї не трогалась. Її ніс наголо студент і літератор. Я йшов під гробом від ніг із третього етапа. Держав його на плечах. Труну не спускали з рук до самого кладовища, до котрого із академії буде верст із 7. Труна була дубова, оббита срібною парчою. На узглаві кришки на срібній дошечці було написано «Український поет Тарас Григорович Шевченко 1861 февраля 24-го дня». Дубову труну положили в Свинцеву через те, що його повезуть на Україну. На поета возложили лавровий вінок, із котрого я увірвав 3 листика і кожний прикладував до його широкого лоба. Із 3 тобі, як справжньому хохлові, як моєму щирому приятелеві, посилаю знак пам'яті моєї і священного для українців Шевченка. Другий піде у Київ, а 3-й останеться у мене. Та ще я відірвав від труни китицю, котру теж думаю тобі подарувати, якщо побачусь з тобою у Харкові, до того времені, поки ти не виїдеш з Харкова. Посилаю тобі ще 2 нитки з китиці, котру я відірвав від труни Шевченка. Одна срібна, друга проста, нитяна. От тобі й похорони Шевченка. Now, I said I wouldn't comment on it, but you can see how the sense of touching the sacred, of the relic, it's already there. And it still affects us. It cannot but affect us. Now, this was put in another key because we always have to balance our impressions, our judgments, by Drahomanov, the essential Ukrainian rationalist and critic. And he said it very well. It is from the ending of the first part of Shevchenko Ukrainofili Socialism, where he speaks to the element of the sacred. It's a longish quote, but I've been told that I can read these, so I will. He said, Kostomarov, in his Воспоминання о двух малярах, a very interesting text, very problematic text, читаємо такі слова. Шевченко був ізбранник народа в прямому значенні цього слова. Народ как бы избрал его петь вместо себя. I'll translate this into English. Шевченко сказав то, що кожен народний чоловік сказав би, якщо б його народне чувство могло возвіситися до способності виразити то, що хранилось на дні його душі. Шевченко возвіститель народних дум, представитель народної волі, істолкуватель народного чувства. Шевченко was chosen by the народ. Now, народ means both people, common people, the folk, the nation, народ, as you know. Was chosen by the народ in the true or direct sense of the term. This is a metaphysics of chosenness. The nation, the people, chose them to represent them. He said what every person from the Narod would say if he could say these, if he could say things that were at the bottom of his soul. Shevchenko is the spokesman of the national thought, or Narodnykh dum, the representative of national will, the explicator of national feeling. And this is Drahomanov now. Те, що в добродія Костомарова говорилось усе-таки світською мовою, he's being ironic, because this is not very secular, this is already metaphysical. He said, here what was being said in a secular way, в Галичині вже просто перекладалось на церковну. І Шевченко звався і в промовах, і в телеграмах, які посилились щороку в день його смерті, святим мучеником, end quotes, пророком і апостолом Русі України. А звісно, listen to this, this is the rational mind talking, а звісно, що ніхто так не мучиться, як святі, пророки і апостоли, от тих, хто їм кланяється. Починається з того, що кожне слово пророка стає святим, не розбираючи коли, як, при чому воно сказане. Далі кожний вірний примазує до святих слів свої, святить словами пророка кожну свою думку, вибирає з тих слів, що йому треба, перекручує їх. Появляється купа Петрів, Павлів, Симонів, Волхвів. Тонкі люди з вірних починають ділити науку на тайну і явну. Починається таке, що і справді святий не розібрав би, коли це якому вірному самому захочеться стати пророком, або придивитися йому Діоклеціан у жандармському мундирі. Тоді пророк стає посланцем не Єгови, а сатани. Тоді ікона пророча летить у болото. Sic semper prophetis. Well, the topic of Shevchenko's reception is one that, as you can infer, that occupies a lot of my thoughts, and I am certainly tempted to go into it. But let me just focus on a few more moments, because I think it is time to conclude. The sacred component in the reception of Shevchenko, as so neatly and ironically emphasized by Drahomanov here, is also evident in the texts themselves of various writers writing under the influence or against the influence of Shevchenko. In Kulish's response and Kostomarov's, but for me the most revealing is the poet Yuri Fedkovich, who seems to be totally hypnotized by Shevchenko and apparently unable to get out from under his influence. There are perhaps, I think, three reasons why this is so, why the element of the sacred, of the Shevchenko as the sacred figure, and this does set him apart both from Mickiewicz and Pushkin, is so evident. One is that the secular mode is less prominent, and that the secular mode is less prominent in the culture, and the elements of pre or anti-secularism and the dominance of populism is evident, and the weakness of the critical tradition. After all, it is only with Shevchenko himself, and then with Kulish and Drahomanov and Franco, that tradition of a critical glance or look or examination of the Ukrainian existence comes into play. Secondly, in that he himself, Shevchenko, encodes the mythical or millenarian paradigm. He creates the paradigm of Ukraine as a sacred space and a sacred entity. It is later generations that give it political meaning. For him, it is pre-political or trans-political. And the best example of this is that he never once uses the term Ukrainets, even though it is quite operant in the ethnonym, the self-designation, is operant in Ukrainian society of that time. Certainly Kulish is using it and Kostomarov is using it. For Shevchenko, Ukraina is such a sacred thing that it does not have its translation into the adjectival form. Thirdly, in that political oppression, and this is the most obvious, is most evident here. Ukrainian culture was more persecuted than that of its neighbors, Poland and Russian. That is to say, it was denied. In symbolic terms, Ukraine was to be annihilated. Не было, нет и быть не может. And in that context, all of these responses, all of these gestures and strategies of maintaining identity become so much more powerful and so much more imbued with the power of the sacred. And most evidently, Shevchenko was important enough, indeed good enough as a poet, to have touched upon all the right strings. He programmed the reception from the beginning. More than any national poet that I know of, his role is so central that it was simply without debate, either then or now. Well, there was. I don't want to exaggerate. There was in the 1890s and the turn of the century, and the modernists were ready to criticize. So was the futurist Semenko and so on. But I think on the whole, the great mainstream of Ukrainian cultural and historical and political development is one that does not challenge Shevchenko's predominant role. Let me turn in conclusion, because I promised to do so, and I find this to be intellectually the most provocative of all things, I hope it provokes you, is to go into the way in which the paradigm of the national poet and that of the national mystification come together in all three of these writers, no longer as an abstract notion, but concretely. The seeds of mystification, for the moment, we can in a very rudimentary, elementary way define it as conscious substitution of the false or the virtual for the real and the authentic. I know it begs a lot of question, how are you valuing these things, but anyway. And as the manipulation and exploitation of a collective need for a personally, voluntaristically interpreted, albeit collective, beneficent higher end, are already implicit in the national poet's symbolic self-designation. At least as I have been putting it here. That is to say, when the poet portrays himself as literally coterminous with the collective, with the nation, when Mickiewicz says, I am million, etc., etc., he is on the one hand skirting what Jung would say massive ego inflation, which becomes all too powerful or palpable and distasteful when lesser poets attempt to do this, And on the other, speaking from the objective, rational perspective is simply engaging in a form of romantic mystification, i.e., this is a poetics, and it's allowed within the poetics of romanticism. But one can also, even more concretely, speak of mystification as inhering in the very process of reception, in the sociology of the poet's canonization. I have already alluded to the fact that Pushkin, the dandy, the esthete, the Casanova, the friend of the Decembrists who just managed not to get involved with them when the time was right, the Kammerjunker and court poet, bred from the time of the Lycée when he was 12 to be a faithful servant of the monarch, and so on. In all of these, Ipostasi was not a very likely candidate for that exalted post. And yet, given the enabling moments that I have discussed, and above all, the topos of martyrdom, and even beyond that, above all, the need of the society, the process of canonization is primed and begins and becomes inexorable. And all those potentially disqualifying moments are simply swept under the rug. In high canonic, i.e. patriotic discourse, it becomes bad form to even mention them. Even the most sympathetic, indeed loving discussion of the national bard, Pushkin, that touches upon some of these issues, as for example, Abram Tertz's relatively recent book, Progulki s Pushkinem, can raise a storm of protest. The same, of course, can be said of Mickiewicz, and certainly of Shevchenko, of which I have some personal knowledge. The issue, after all, is systemic. The issue is systemic, not particular. In the case of Mickiewicz, we have the curious instance of a self-avowed national vieszcz, who also implicitly casts himself as a leader of and sufferer for the national cause, the already mentioned Konrad Wallenrod, who not only draws on an official government stipend after leaving Russia, he leaves Russia in 1828 with a Russian government grant, as we call him now, but when the hour of greatest national crisis arises, the November 1830 Polish uprising, cannot tear himself away from his Russian aristocratic friends in Rome and dallies there for months. And by a circuitous route, he manages to get only as far as Poznań, but by then the uprising is over and everybody's leaving from Warsaw to Dresden and Paris. He joins the retreating patriot and becomes one of the emigres. He writes his best works, Dziady Part 3, Księgi Narodu, and then Pantadeusz, and becomes a spiritual leader of the emigres. While some did remember his absence, there were a lot of people who were unhappy by the fact that the national vieszcz was not in Warsaw fighting, but somewhere in Rome and then in Poznań waiting. But somehow, this was not important. The skepsis was overshadowed, and these real-life ambivalences recede ever further into the shadows, and it's very hard to find in contemporary Polish Mickiewiczologia open discussion of this. Although when you discuss it with scholars, they say, yes, indeed, these are biographical facts, very complex, very interesting, and indeed problematic. But the role of national bard simply cannot tolerate them. Now, though it may appear surprising to some, similar ambivalence can be found in Shevchenko. It cannot but be there. And it is not a matter of sexual or gender ambivalence, which the traditionalists in Ukrainian societies are half expecting me to speak to. It's not that. To put it most succinctly, it is the presence in his total corpus of what I have called a duality of, and I have no better terms, and in Ukraine many people don't like them because they have political connotations, but I simply call it adjusted and unadjusted literary personae. In Ukraine it's pristosovani, nepristosovani, and the problem is that Ukrainian pristosovani means a conformist, a lickspittel. That's not what I mean. I mean in a purely psychological way, more or less adjusted, as it were, to social overarching reality. And they express themselves in Shevchenko on both sides of the Ukrainian-Russian linguistic divide. To the extent that Shevchenko is organically integrated into both Ukrainian and Imperial Russian society, because he functions in both of them perfectly well. It's not as if he functions only in Ukrainian society as a Kobzar, and in Russian society as some kind of a mute, you know, autistic, you know, bump on the log. He's very active. He is a member, full-fledged, active member of Russian Imperial Society. According to the topos of the national poet, the Kobzar, he is a hybrid. Indeed, in this Ukrainianness cum Russianness, an ambivalent and thus an impure figure. And the subsequent popular reception to this day must turn a blind eye to it. That is to say, and I stress popular, the scholars certainly write about it, but the popular reception blanks this out. In his own day, Shevchenko, with wit and conscious irony, concealed it with the peasant hat and coat, the shapka and the kozhukh, which he wore over his black tie when in Petersburg society. You have it in the picture. There's a picture. He's dressed in tie and tails, and over it he has a coat and hat. In short, the paradigm of national poet is totalizing and essentialist. And as all such symbolic evocations of the sacred, it simply must distance and conceal the out-of-frame, real-life material. From an objectivist point of view, the paradigm is itself a mystification. I stress that, and not from from the other moments that are also there. But this is where the dialogue, the Rizno B, comes in. The best evidence for this is the historical record and the overarching fact that in the historiography of each literature, this has seldom been an area of concerted inquiry, and indeed the tradition as such seems to have militated against it. Only now is a more searching, deconstructive, and secularizing focus being applied to Mickiewicz. And this reflects far-reaching changes in Polish society. There is no doubt that most of this is being done in Poland as compared to Russia and Ukraine, because society has changed. It is now obviously open and easy, or relatively easy, to do this. In Ukrainian and in Russian society, the mythographic mode and mindset are still ascendant. But while Pushkin is an icon, Shevchenko is that and more. The discourse around him and his role in the collective consciousness are remarkably, perhaps uniquely, charged with the aura of the sacred. And it is not a trivial matter, as we can tell just by touching the texts. In the sense of focusing collective identity and collective self-worth, he remains a prophet. Perhaps more than any national poet, he exemplifies the tautology of this paradigm and its resilience. Thank you.